snap. The kick is in the air, and the kick this time is no, sir, Ree. No, sir, Ree. Final score, Tennessee 20, Florida 17. Pandemonium reigns.
You're listening to the RTI Podcast, powered by WalkieTalkInsider.com.
Trey Wallace, RTI Podcast on this Tuesday. Happy to be joined by Braden Gall from 440 Sports. What's up, Braden? How are you, buddy?
Oh, man. I'm great. You know, kids sent home, quarantined from school. Couldn't get out of this whole thing. You know, had a vaccine set up next week. Couldn't get out of this whole thing without having to work from home with two small children, the wife and I, for the final couple of weeks, because, you know, that's just the way the 54th week of March is going to end for us. You know,
come on now, don't jinx us. We got a little bit of while to go. So let's not everybody's getting it. So no, that absolutely stinks. But your city, man, Nashville is about to host the SEC tournament. Can you believe it's been a year since where we were from last year and going into that second day of the tournament that we're sitting here now and we're still trying to we're putting this thing together?
It's really nuts. And I'm a big college baseball guy too. I love it as a fan. I've had to cover it a couple of times in Omaha, and just this week in particular, we are literally this time last year. March 11th was the night that sort of the entire sports world shut down. And then I remember, wasn't it Tennessee that was playing on a Friday morning?
Yeah, they were going to play. I think they were going to play Alabama that morning.
And I was on the media bus. Like, I had parked in the lot. I live about 3 miles actually from the arena. So I've covered a lot of SEC tournaments at Bridgestone. And I was on the bus when I was like the whole media throng is scrolling through their phones, going looking at Greg Sankey's statement saying, you know, that the SEC tournament has been postponed. And I was like, well, I guess my Friday just opened up.
I mean, so it was surreal. Yeah.
It was so nuts. And I just remember that Wednesday evening being on the air trying to tell people, guys, we need to be prepared for there not to be an NCAA tournament. Like, the NBA is being canceled. Tom Hanks has COVID. Let's not go crazy. Let's handle it appropriately. Let's be smart. Let's not run through the streets naked with our hair on fire. But we've got to acknowledge that this is a real issue. And that was the night that Rudy Gobert in the NBA had tested positive and was touching all the reporters' microphones. What a move, what a tool bag move that was by Rudy Gobert. But yeah, fast forward and here we are optimistic and ready to get this whole thing over with. But you're right. It's hard to believe. And we had a tornado, frankly, Nashville, not to get off
right
here, but my daughters, I have a 2 and a 4-year-old daughter, their daycare, that school, our church, the pizza place we go to, the burger joint we used to take our babies to, everything was hit by a tornado the week before the whole pandemic had happened. So Nashville was just, this time last year was just one of the craziest times in our lives ever. As a city, as sports fans, as a family, it was just a really crazy time. And I had a 1 and a 3-year-old at home at that time. So man, I learned a lot about myself, but hey, if the worst thing that happened to me was I got to play with my kids a little bit more, I can't complain. So
No, and I agree with you, and that's good too. And I remember that night, that Wednesday night, I'd gone to the arena, I'd watched the 13-14 game, I'd gone back to the hotel on West End, I'm watching the news, all of a sudden the Rudy Gobert stuff starts coming out, and it's like, uh-oh, okay, this is going to be interesting. And I remember staying up till probably 3:30 that morning, 4 o'clock, just kind of watching everything and following it. And then I went to the arena, and they were going to play a basketball game. You know, Tennessee was getting ready in the locker room, Bob Kessling's getting ready right there on Radio Row. And I remember I walked up to Bob and I said, are we doing this? And he goes, no, it's over. And that was that moment where everything kind of stood still for a little bit. And now we sit here, you know, a year later, and we're about to do this thing again, starting on Wednesday. You know,
Real quickly, right, I remember, I think I saw you the Thursday before it all got canceled, at the games.
Right.
Maybe. And I just remember I was sitting next to some guys from The Athletic, I think, and we were sitting there talking about how weird it was to not have fans around. And we're just like, God, this is so weird. And like, no one was focused on the game itself. You know, like when like Georgia's playing basketball on a Thursday in the SEC tournament, it's not exactly like must see, right, pay attention to every possession or whatever. And that's not a knock on Georgia. I'm just saying. It was just so, I just remember sitting there, like looking around going like, this is so weird. And now I've gone to hockey games. I've gone to soccer matches. I've gone to NFL games. I've gone to college games. I've covered a lot of these events. And it's just like, it's going to be weird when we have fans back in the stands again, full capacity. And we should be able to do that next fall. And that's exciting for everybody. But I just remember thinking how weird it was in the moment. And then little did I know I was going to spend the next year going to empty stadiums, you know, just such a weird,
right?
God, what a weird time.
Well, you know, and looking into it and carrying that on to football, were you surprised, maybe is the wrong word, but were you taken aback that we got through the whole football season without any problem and got to an SEC title game and a national championship game? Like, overall, it was just a crazy year because it never felt like a home environment for anybody unless you were in College Station with their 50,000 some odd fans. But are you surprised that we got this far without any problems this past year?
Well, and I don't, you know, I'm not a scientist here, so I don't have any clue really about this, but like as a parent, I'm not surprised that we got all the game, as many games as we did in. I don't think it's like as cool and as chic to like dunk on the Big Ten for doing what they did. I think everybody approached this in their own way, and people being more cautious. I don't think people being more cautious should be vilified. That was politicized through this entire process and still is with the Big Ten, the revelations that the Big Ten sort of was keeping everything on a private server. I'd like to see Greg Sankey's communications, frankly. Like if what the Big Ten did was so wrong by moving everything to a private server so it couldn't be FOIA'd, doesn't that mean that we can see all of Greg Sankey's communications? Because Greg Sankey, you know, famously was not telling anybody anything, right? We're not going to tell you how many schools have had positive COVID tests. We're not going to tell you how many kids. Missouri actually probably did the best job of actually being transparent.
I agree.
And I think transparency, and not, this is sort of a different topic here, but I think transparency is the biggest problem in college athletics. Number one across the board in every sport, but mostly football and basketball. And we're seeing what's happening with LSU and Les Miles and the current situation there. It's why the Baylor and the Penn State sagas take place, is because there is no transparency. It's not good for fans who want to get to know their players to never, ever get to see them practice. Like, wouldn't it be, can you imagine Tennessee fans getting to watch this four-person quarterback battle in the fall, like in the summer camp? Do we really think that Tennessee is going to lose games because the media is allowed to watch those quarterbacks compete against each other in practice?
Well, even no. Like what Missouri's doing. I mean, Missouri's holding three open practices for right. fans to go watch.
it's the NFL. Look at the NFL has open practices to media every single day, and teams still miraculously win Super Bowls. I don't know how that happens. I just think these little feudal dictators – it's not good for anybody. It's not good for the fans. It's not good for the student athletes who then can grow their brand a little bit more, right, with name, image, and likeness coming. It's not good for literally women on campus. Like, it's literally an unhealthy situation to prioritize the success of your football program and millions of dollars over the health and safety of women on your campus or anybody on your campus.
Right.
And that is unfortunately what happens without transparency. So there's just a million reasons why more transparency would be good. I would pay to watch the Tennessee quarterback battle. Like, I would pay $39.99 for live stream of the position battle, right? Like, I think fans would pay for that. And so there, you want to create a revenue stream and create some transparency while not giving up any competitive advantages. Cause let's just be honest, it's not going to change. Tennessee's win loss record is not going to change if you get to watch practice, you know? No. So I just think it would be healthier. It would be great for the sport for everyone to get to see all that stuff. And frankly, LSU is just the next one. And if you don't think it can happen on your campus, you're just being naive and ignorant. It can happen on any campus in America. And it's bad and unhealthy for the sport. We need more transparency. And that goes for COVID too. Like, I want to see all of the emails that Greg Sankey had with all the presidents in the school, in the university, because maybe there's proof in there that they did it really, really well. You know, maybe there's proof in there that they didn't. I don't know, but like, transparency is better for everybody, in my opinion.
With the Les Miles situation and LSU and Jeff Long, and you just run down the list, Joe Oliva, when he was athletic director down there, and it happening in 2013, and then a little bit, you know, a year after. But everything was held so tight, and just it was such a secret, and they did not let it get out. And it took, you know, USA Today taking LSU to court and suing them to get an internal investigation from back in 2013 that is just absolutely damaging to the university, but also to the head coach. Like, how did they get to this point in Baton Rouge where now we're talking about them in this light? And then Les Miles just lost his job as well.
Well, it is. And again, it's today it's LSU. Tomorrow could be you, right? It could be anybody's favorite team in college football. It's Zach Smith at Ohio State. It's Joe Paterno at Penn State. It's Baylor. It's Jameis Winston at Florida State. If your team is good and successful and is winning, unfortunately, the system is set up to fail, especially women on campuses. It's just set. What you are doing is you are asking people to do the right thing in the face of intense financial pressure. And that is a system, in my opinion, that maybe I'm a cynic here, is just sort of set up to fail. And of course, there are wonderful people. Of course, there are the good coaches and good men and women out there that are working in these athletic departments that try to do everything the right way. But when you have 67 football staffers who are paid employees and one in the Title IX office, you are setting up that system to fail on purpose, okay, right? And, yep. And so I just, where we prioritize things is has always been crazy in this country. And I don't, you know, Tyreek Hill gets paid $14 million a year because he can run a fly pattern and teachers don't, right? Like, that's just the way it is. That's capitalism. Some of that you just have to accept in life, but not on our campuses when we're talking about our children, right? Like this right. is a little, this is different. And it's, and I've asked Greg Sankey this to his face. I said, you know, Greg, have you ever considered putting in transparency, some measures of transparency from the top down as a conference? And his answer to me was, we'll never do it at the conference level. We want that to come from the ground up, from the school level. And the problem with that is it's just never going to happen, because as long as you give the highest paid employee at every one of these schools, Tennessee, Alabama, you know, Florida, Georgia, you name it, the highest paid state employee is the football coach. And when they're winning, no one can challenge them. No one can challenge their authority. No one can challenge their decision-making. Les Miles got away with whatever he wanted to, even though he doesn't. Les Miles to me is like, there's like a creepy douche factor with him, but
yeah,
what LSU did as a university is there's some criminal stuff there. Right. So there's a little bit of a difference between covering up domestic abuse and being super creepy in the workplace, right? Like, you can get fired for your job, but I don't think you can go to prison for some of the things that Les Miles did, right? Like hitting on a woman inappropriately. You don't go to prison for that. You cover up Darius Geis's rape allegations, I think you should go to prison for some of that stuff. So, like, or maybe there should be some criminal charges there, whatever. Again, not a lawyer, not a police officer, but
it's also transparency too. When you talk about it, it's like, well, why the hell did they not vet him at Kansas for stuff like this? All you had to do was make a phone call.
You've been around this long enough. Do you really believe that they didn't know?
I agree. I think they knew.
These coaches, the media, the athletic directors, you know, I've been to the AFCA, the American Football Coaches Association meeting. I've sat in the Grand Ole Opry balcony with like six head coaches. They all, SEC media days, everyone gossips like school children. Like, they all gossip. Everybody talks, the media included. So I find it hard to believe that Les Miles wasn't allowed to be alone in a room with a woman, which should never be a thing, by the way. That shouldn't even be an option as a punishment. It should just, like, if you can't be alone in a room with a woman, you should be fired. Like, that's it. I find it hard to believe that the back, you know, off the record, back channel conversations that people didn't know. Like, Jeff Long tried to hire him at Arkansas.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I find that hard to believe. I think these guys all know everything about everything.
No, I completely agree. And it's all about the agency world. And you know that too. And it is what it is. Now, Kansas is.
Sorry, I'm worked up here. I'm sorry.
No, Kansas is in a crapshoot. And LSU is going to deal with this nonsense because they brought it upon themselves and they didn't do anything for it for years to come. I mean, that's just how it is. Let's move on to Tennessee. So yesterday, Josh Heupel on Monday introduced his defensive staff at Tennessee. So everybody's been introduced now. We can move on from that part. They can get ready for spring practice and whatnot. But what did you take away from the hiring process that Josh Heupel and Danny White did over the course of a month when it comes to this staff. Both off, I mean, it's the same staff that they brought from UCF on the offensive side, you know, besides Mac and running back. But what were your what's your opinion on how things played out defensively?
I'm not going to have any strong opinions individually on, you know, like Eckler or Martinez or like Garner or any of these guys. Like, I think we'll just have to see. Cause again, what did we talk about with the old staff, right? Man, Jeremy Pruitt's putting together one of the best staffs we've ever seen. This Niederreiter guy is pretty damn good at recruiting. We love what this coaching staff looks like. It turns out that was all the downfall in theory to some degree. And so it's hard to sort of look at each individual guy and sort of say, all right, the defensive line coach, really love him. Not sure about linebackers. You know, that's hard for me to do. We just don't know a ton about these guys as far as, you know, upside. They're not a bunch of huge names. Tim Banks, we know a lot more about him. And I think we can have a much deeper conversation about how that hiring process went down and what does he bring to the table? How far down the list was he on Josh Heupel's list? This is the same conversation we could have about Danny White's hiring of Josh Heupel, right? Like, we know he went out and talked to other people. You and I probably both know it definitively. And we know that there were conversations with other coaches. And like, again, if Josh Heupel's your number one guy, why isn't he on the plane with you when you fly up from Orlando the first time, right? So we know for a fact that there were five or six other names attached to the defensive coordinator job before Tim Banks got the job. You know, track record, you know, it is what it is. Like, worked for Butch Jones, worked for Tim Beckman, worked for James Franklin. Like, these are some interesting characters, right? And he's got tons of experience sort of close to the top level of running a defense. But my biggest question is, is he good enough in the SEC, in the toughest conference in America with the best players in the league, in the country, is he good enough on by himself to design and implement a defense that beats the best teams? Do I think Josh Heupel's offense is good enough with that coaching staff, with their identity and the way they're going to sling it around and score points a la Ole Miss this year and maybe in the future? Are they good enough to beat teams that they have better players than? Yes, they will be. Kentucky, Missouri, South Carolina, Vanderbilt. Is Tim Banks good enough to elevate the defense to where they are beating people schematically and development-wise where the other team has better players? Because we know Bama, Georgia, and Florida is just going to have better players for the foreseeable future, right? So that's my concern. And he's sort of just been a co-DC everywhere he's been. He hasn't really been the true, you know, designer and implementer and play caller of a defense since almost a decade. You have to go back to frankly Butch Jones' time. Here's the other thing, and here's a little nugget that I gathered doing some research on this. Brent Pry is the guy who runs the defense at Penn State. He was the co-defensive coordinator with Tim Banks, but it's Pry's defense. And if he would have left, I have been told on pretty good authority that the guy who would have gotten the job wasn't Tim Banks. So in theory, that makes him the third best defensive coordinator at Penn State last year.
True.
That's not exactly an overwhelming bullet point on the resume. It does not mean he's not going to be good. It does not mean that now that he's given the chance that he won't be able to do something special with that. He deserves an opportunity. But if you're asking me, is he better than the guy who was already on staff and that you're paying anyway, you know where I'm going here.
Yep.
He's just not better. Like, I don't think you can argue that Tim Banks is better than Kevin Steele. Is he better for Josh Heupel? Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. But if you're telling me a guy who's already on staff that you're going to honor his contract, he's got experience recruiting in the SEC, who basically changed Auburn's identity when he got there. It went from the Gus bus and the Gus offense to, damn, Auburn's good on defense, right? Like, that was their identity under the Kevin Steele, Gus Malzahn thing. I know you'd have to have an adult conversation with him and say, look, you have zero chance of stabbing me in the back to get this job. I need you to be a big boy and run the defense and recruit like crazy. I don't know why you two adult men can't come to that conclusion, because I still think that would have been better for Josh Heupel's career.
Go down that road, though. Like, why? And let's be honest. Like, in this contract, it says he has to be an assistant coach, you know, and this is the amount of money he's paying. This was a game of chicken all along with Tennessee, because if he walked away from Tennessee, that would end up probably affecting his buyout from Auburn, because he quit a job without being let go. So it was a game of chicken the whole time. But my question is, and I want your opinion, why do you think, is it because Heupel knew the reputation of Kevin Steele, or is it maybe a difference in philosophy in not wanting an arranged marriage?
I mean, probably there's good cases to be made in both of those categories, right? Like I'm a new head coach. I'm coming to the SEC for the first time. I want to pick my guys. Of course, everybody wants that. I want the system and the scheme that I want. Of course, everybody wants that. However, after you then watch the thing unfold, at what point is Kevin Steele somewhere on your list, right? Like at this point, Kevin Steele is like eighth on your list. That seems irrational. You have to weigh the risk and reward, right? To me, if I'm Heupel, it's a risk reward proposition. There's certainly some risk involved in hiring someone who's sort of been betrothed to you in some degree and who has, you know, maybe he was involved in pushing Gus Malzahn out at Auburn. So there is some, like, you know, interpersonal dynamic there that maybe you have some concern about, and that's okay. That's the risk you take when you're a big boy coach in the SEC, right? But what's the reward? To me, the reward vastly outweighs that risk, because you're the boss, you're the head coach. You should be able to sit somebody down and say, look, man, we're going to do it this way. And I'm going to give you space to work. I'm going to give you space to run the defense, but there's a clear chain of command here. And that should not be difficult for head coaches to do, especially if you're worthy of being an SEC head coach. So to me, that's your risk part of this. The reward is, you're going to get a guy who's been a defensive coordinator in the SEC and knows the SEC, who played at Tennessee, who's recruited in the SEC, some of the best defensive players in the SEC for the last 5 years, who is a proven commodity. Like, this isn't Jim Chaney proven. This is one of the better defenses in the country proven, right? Like, just ask him.
Yeah, who's also worked with Rodney Garner, who Tennessee went out higher before they hired a defensive coordinator.
So here's the entire interview for me. Here's the entire interview. I would walk in. If I had like truth serum and I could inject Josh Heupel into the side of his neck with some truth serum, I'd walk in and I say, how difficult was Auburn to prepare for when you were coaching with one of the best quarterbacks in SEC history from a production standpoint, when you were running Missouri's offense and you got beat 51-14 and you had Drew Locke, who threw 44 touchdowns that year and set an SEC record, and you got totally dominated by Auburn? How difficult was it for you to game plan for Kevin Steele's defense? And if his answer is, damn, that was pretty good defense, pretty tough. It wasn't just the talent gap. The scheme was sound, the development, the physicality. They out-schemed us. They out, you know, whatever. If the answer is like, damn, that was a pretty good defense, to me, it's a no-brainer. You hire Kevin Steele. If you walk into that, if I give him truth serum and I say, how difficult was that game for you? And he says, well, they didn't really do anything that complicated. Auburn just had better players than us. And he's telling us the truth. Okay, maybe Kevin Steele's not as great as we think he is. But he's the offensive coordinator who schemed against it. He should know exactly how good Kevin Steele's defense is.
Which is the crazy part in all of this. And then that saga, he'll get paid and he'll go be an analyst somewhere where he can get the most money he can from Auburn to Tennessee at the same time. And also, he'll be a coach that's getting three paychecks from three different universities at the same time. God bless America.
I used to work with Houston Nutman, and I'm telling you, he'd walk around going, buyout life's the life, baby. That buyout life is the life, man. I'm telling you.
A couple more questions. I want to hit on Danny White for a minute. Tennessee has themselves a situation where they have got to sell season tickets. They've got to build back some kind of momentum and excitement into this program, especially if you're going to be having crowds at capacity next year at Neyland Stadium. You don't want it, you know, 60,000 fans to show up when there could be 100,000 fans. What do you think the biggest obstacles are over, besides the obvious, over the next 6 to 7 months to get some kind of excitement into this Tennessee football program where it will show up on Saturdays?
So this is where I think you have to be creative and use your assets, right? And right now the asset, because I'll be very clear about this. I don't believe that the coach who's going to be coaching Tennessee through this situation, out of the Jeremy Pruitt era, through the NCAA stuff and into the future, is not going to be the same guy who's taking them to the championship level. I think that's going to be two different coaches. So I'll be very clear about that. I think Josh Heupel's a solid football coach. He's a sound hire. I don't think he has got championship upside. I don't think that offense is going to beat Alabama, Florida, and Georgia consistently enough to win the SEC. But I think he's a solid coach. And what is his biggest asset? His asset is the offense. They're going to have an identity. They're going to be able to score, and they're going to be a little bit more fun to watch than they were in the past, I don't know, 9 seasons or whatever. That's It'll be right. it got maybe 12 seasons. It, you know, certainly Lane Kiffin worked wonders with Jonathan Crompton in 09. But I think, and this is, you talk about marketability, you talk about transparency, you talk about leaning into the future with name, image, and likeness. There's a lot of different things you can create and do differently than other teams in the SEC. And you have a quarterback battle with four guys that are all very different, not only just a skill set standpoint, but sort of in their careers, right? You've got four guys that sort of are in different stages of life. I am making that as public as possible. Number one, if you are a young player or an older player like Hendon Hooker, and a little mental pressure breaks you to where you can't compete on Saturdays, I'm sorry, you're not QB1 in the SEC. If you can't handle a little media pressure on a quarterback battle, sorry, dude, the job ain't for you. So what I'm doing is I'm making that as public as possible. The fans will love it. It'll generate excitement. You harness the power of your strength, which is the offensive identity and the way you're going to sling it around. Show people what's going on. I'm not saying give away state secrets. I'm not
right.
saying
no, I get it. Yeah.
I'm not saying throw a kid under the bus when he has a terrible practice. You know what I'm saying? I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying market the quarterback battle. Market it publicly, outwardly. Put it on, like, cut up some film and, like, have a coach do some, like, actual, like put it out. Can you imagine how much traffic you would get on a 1.5-minute video with Heupel breaking down Brian Maurer's practice that day? Can you imagine what kind of publicity and interest you would gain from Tennessee fans? And, oh, by the way, how much goodwill it builds up, right? Like, look, this coach is showing us everything. He wants to connect with us. And then it's all about how you sell it, right? You like, look, we want to bring you in, guys. Tennessee fans, buy into what we're doing. We're going to bring you into the room. We're going to bring you onto the practice field. We're going to bring you into the strategy and connect with you like no one's ever connected with you before. Because what else do you have to sell right now? The roster is terrible. Like, they're not going to stop anybody on defense. They're not going to win more games than they lose. It's not going to be fixed right away. So I think you got to take your one thing, which is a fun, exciting offense and a really interesting quarterback battle with four pretty interesting people. Oh, by the way, heaven forbid we get to know these kids, right? Like, the fans will love you for that. I don't know. That's just me. It comes with some negatives. It comes with some, like, you got to teach these young kids about how to handle social media and how to act in front of a microphone and all that stuff. But guess what they have to do in real life? Like, they're going to have to do that eventually. So,
well, it's it's nothing that we haven't done in the past when we're interviewing players on a Tuesday. You know what I mean? It's just different. And I agree with you in what you're talking about. You have to get outside the box when it comes to generating some kind of excitement for this program. You're not going to do it on defense, because everything that's been talked about the last 3 weeks is Henry Toa and Crouch. Okay, well, newsflash. I mean, Crouch was practicing with the team last week. Now, all of a sudden, he's not on the team, according to the defensive coordinator and the linebackers coach this week. Henry Toa is in California taking classes. That ship sailed, okay, with Toa. If he was going to return back to Tennessee, Braden, he'd already be at Tennessee. So now you have to figure out who is your next person you can market in this football program. And I think they have the wide receivers to do it. I think they have the quarterbacks to do it. Defensively, that's going to be tough besides like Alante Taylor and maybe a Jeremy Banks. But on offense, you do have the wide receiver in the quarterback spot that you can expose and you can put it out there. I agree with you, brother.
Well, and again, I just think it's a better business model. Like, imagine going on the recruiting trail if you're Josh Heupel, right? Which is also a big part of this. Josh Heupel has to immediately build relationships and make his, you know, with coaches in Tennessee. Now, I know he's recruited the SEC before and certainly coached in the Southeast a lot, but he's going to have to immediately start selling something to somebody, right? And if I can go to a mom and a dad and a kid and say, look, we're going to teach your son how to speak to the media. We're going to teach him how to market and brand himself, maybe generate a little revenue for himself on the up and up that's clean. And those are life skills he can learn. Plus, these kids already know how to use social media. It's not like they don't know how to do it. Like, they know how to market themselves on social media platforms. Lean into this stuff. Like, I think it's valuable on the recruiting trail. It's valuable with your fan base to build a connection. And by the way, players are going to love it. When you lean into letting them have a personality, lean into letting them sort of be their own brand, lean into the new thing that's coming to college football, name, image, and likeness, player voices, having a platform, all this stuff. No one else is doing it. Like, no one is doing, there's a few coaches that are doing it well, but nobody, like PJ Fleck at Minnesota, is doing it pretty well. And frankly, Jeremy Pruitt did a pretty good job of this in the summer during all the protest stuff. I give him a lot of credit for that. It's like one of the only things he did right, right, and did well. It seemed like there was an organized plan there. But I don't know. I just think the coach who leans into the new next evolution of college football the best is going to find success quicker. And Josh Heupel needs every bit of those that he can find right now. And
that's why Danny White was brought in too, though. I mean, his marketing staff, right? I mean, it's him.
No, he is. Again, I'm very – again, I don't believe Josh Heupel is going to win championships in the SEC. But I do believe they've sort of fixed some of the underlying foundational issues with the program, at least for now. We'll see how long it lasts. But Dondi Plowman sort of deciding with a big decision to hire Danny White, a professional athletic director doesn't have to be a Tennessee guy, to come in and manage things and run things on their own with some power and authority. That is how you start to rebuild Tennessee football. And that was why I was so excited about how that process played out, is that it felt planned and organized from the beginning. She hired the law firm a week after hearing the same week of the allegations, right? So the whole thing seemed orchestrated to me. And that's not a thing that Tennessee football has experienced for 15 years. Plans, organization, professional structure, you know, not too many cooks in the kitchen, singular voices, authority, chain of command. Like, these are important things in college football. Tennessee hasn't had any of them. It does feel like they've got some of that now.
Let's switch over to basketball real quick. This Tennessee team has been off and on this year so much. And I hate to, you know, I'm not going to attack John Fulkerson. John Fulkerson just had a rough year. It is what it is. And he'll be the first one to tell you that. But also, I don't think they've gotten a lot out of players like Eve Pons as well, every single game. And then having to throw in the two freshmen. And then you got Vescovi, who's hot and cold when it comes to shooting. What do you think about this Tennessee basketball team this year? Did they get caught up right there in the middle of the season, having to switch their entire game? Is that what happened with them?
Maybe. They beat Vanderbilt by 20, I don't know, like 6-7 weeks ago. They're 6-6 since then. They haven't gotten better. Like, they're not a better basketball team today. Rick Barnes has not made them better. I don't know if that's because they're young, because of the pandemic, because no training camp, because, like you said, Fulkerson and Pons haven't done what we expected them to do. You can point to a lot of things, but isn't that all Rick Barnes' job?
Yep.
Like, that's Rick Barnes' job to do all of that stuff. So, I think we can also hold this. I'm big on, like, two things being true at the same time. And Rick Barnes was an excellent hire for Tennessee, way better than I ever anticipated. I'll put my hand up and say, not sure I see it when Tennessee made this move. But he's clearly been a great hire for Tennessee, and he's an excellent coach for Tennessee basketball. Some of the questions about why he was let go at Texas were about upside in the tournament. And this is a postseason sport where you are gauged and graded on what you do in the postseason. And you're starting to see some of those questions now with Rick Barnes at Tennessee. It doesn't mean he's not a great coach and a great hire and a great fit to Tennessee. He is. So two things are true here, right? You can still ask questions about why hasn't this team gotten better over the last 6 weeks? I'm not as shocked at Fulkerson's struggles, I think, as some people are.
They figured him out.
Right. That's what I'm. Yeah, exactly. The book is out on him, and he's not one of these dominant lottery pick athletic freaks. Like, he's just not. And that's not an insult to John Fulkerson. I think everybody loves John Fulkerson, but, you know, he's not Joel Embiid. Okay, guys. Like, I don't know why people expected him to be like an 18-12 guy every night. I just don't. So I don't. Maybe expectations were a little too high for him in the preseason, and that may be unfair on him. But he's also asked some accountability in this. It hasn't worked. And I'm with you. I think the book was out on him, and coaches know how to go after him. Like, the Kentucky loss at home, like, they could not go inside to save their life. Could not go inside. And Kentucky just said, we're just going to stand here. We're just going to stand here in the paint, and we're going to let you pass it around out there and mess, you know, play with your PUD and take a bunch of jump shots. And we're going to beat you by 15 or whatever. And so that, you know, that's not going to, Rick Barnes has to find a solution to that, right? That's his job. And you can't just say, all right, Keon Johnson, grow up. How about Keon Johnson, go into the post. Let's throw you the ball and let that junkyard dog you got inside of you go to work. because they were not getting the ball inside. So, again, I'm not a basketball coach. I'm not a basketball expert, so I'm not going to pretend to be one. But this team could get hot. We've seen Konzo Martin teams do it at Tennessee. We've seen Bruce Pearl teams do it at Tennessee. Not great seasons and then good runs into the tournament. You know, they also could get beat in the first round. So it's just – let's see what happens. And everybody in college basketball is judged in March. And Rick Barnes.
Well, no, and I even look at last season, Braden, where they were playing some decent basketball towards the end of the year. And then all of a sudden the SEC tournament kind of happened. It's just,
right.
I mean, I agree with you. I'm interested to hear, do you think Tennessee can win three games in a row? And I'm talking about, I guess, this weekend. Because the NCAA tournament, that's going to be a crapshoot. But can this Tennessee team win on a Friday, a Saturday, a Sunday? They came close 2 years ago, but they ran out of gas against Auburn.
I think they're capable of. I mean, and you know, I do. Here's the thing: I think Arkansas is really dangerous. I think Arkansas is a really dangerous team. Yep. So I know Alabama's been clearly the best in the league, but I think Arkansas is sneaky dangerous. LSU is totally beatable. I mean, LSU is nothing special. They're a solid basketball team, but they're not better than Tennessee per se. I know how it went down in Baton Rouge, but absolutely they can. I mean, running through a 9 seed in the NCAA tournament, which is what LSU sort of pegged right now, a 5 or 6 seed in Arkansas, and then maybe a 2 or 3 seed in Alabama. That's nothing. That's not crazy. That's not trying to beat Gonzaga in 3 years. That's not vintage Kentucky, you know? So can you beat Florida again? That's something you're going to have to do, right, in the first game, should Florida move on. And then you see what happens from there. Can you beat Bama and then beat Arkansas? That's a tougher road. But, you know, if you told me it's Florida, Bama, LSU, that's not exactly the greatest teams in college basketball. So I think they can do it. There's a really high ceiling for this team. There's a really low floor for this team. They are not like that middle ground – where I think you could argue that Admiral Schofield team and Grant Williams team that was the 3 seed that lost to Purdue, I think you could argue that was we know this team is guaranteed to make the second weekend, but they're probably not talented enough to go much further. Like that felt like a high floor, low ceiling team. This team feels like a really high ceiling if things go right and a really low floor if things go bad. I could see them going Elite 8. I could see them being knocked out in the first round.
See, that's kind of where I was at. Like you get out of the first round, you lose in the second round, and the season's over. Like, I can see that happening if they don't get hot. So, I agree 100%. That's why the SEC tournament is going to be wild starting Wednesday night with one game because Auburn can't play in it because of Bruce Pearl, whatever. That's a different story for a different day.
Shocking. Shocking. Bruce Pearl's program is under sanctions. I'm shocked by this.
Oh, my gosh. You know, you might as well throw Rush Probst into all this, too, and just call it.
Dude, I have a Bruce. I don't even think I can tell it, man. I don't even think I can tell it. I have a Bruce Pearl story. One day when I'm allowed to tell it, oh my god,
I can't wait. No,
I was sitting in his office. That's how it starts.
That is absolutely beautiful. And one day we'll get to that. Hey, on your way out, Tennessee baseball and Tony Vitello. Tennessee's got themselves a hell of a baseball coach, I feel like, and they better do everything they can to keep this man after this season is over.
Preach.
Right. And especially if you have to promise facility upgrades, if you have to promise, hey, in 2 or 3 years, we'll start playing at the Smoky Stadium. I don't care what it is. Braden, your opinion on the Tennessee baseball program and how much that is key in Danny White doing whatever is needed to make sure Tony doesn't go anywhere.
You want to talk about things you could do. You can't fix the football program overnight. It takes time, takes a lot of money, takes a lot of people pulling in the same direction. The basketball program's in great shape. You know, Lady Vols, okay, we're seeing progress, right? We'll see. But this baseball program, and I sat in the stands at Lindsey Nelson and watched Lou Coach Aver pitch when my senior year of college. Like I love college baseball. I've been to basically every regional and super regional that Vanderbilt's hosted here in Nashville since I've lived here. I've been to Omaha multiple times to cover the event. I absolutely love the game. I think it's one of the more, like, I'm all about the ping, baby. I love it. And so to see this program be at, like, to not even be making SEC tournaments is absurd for Tennessee baseball. Like, that, for that chunk of time. And we know that Vitello, there's a chance that he's earmarked to take over for Dave Van Horn in Arkansas.
Yep.
And that is a problem. That is a major problem. And I would walk into his office if I'm Danny White and I say, what do you want? What do you want? And you look at facilities in this conference in baseball around the sport, and you got the secrets, you know, super secret pitching lab under the stadium at Vanderbilt. You got the box at LSU. Mississippi State just renovated their building. Like, we are talking about some of the best in the country. And Tennessee might be one of the worst, if not the worst facility in the SEC, right?
It's bad, bro. I mean, my alumni, South Alabama baseball stadium destroys Tennessee.
Oklahoma State just opened up like a $70 million facility. Okay, this is what we need Tennessee to do, because I'm with you. I'm a huge fan of this product. I love college baseball, and for Tennessee not to be good, it doesn't take as much investment. Like, that's why Vanderbilt's so good at baseball. They realized a long time ago, to win at football, you need $200 million a year. To win at baseball, you need like 15. And what? They went and hired arguably the best coach in America. They've won national championships because of it. They've got maybe the top two pitchers in the entire world right now, as far as prospects go into the major league draft, and Rocker and Leiter. Like, they are a machine, and it's because it doesn't take as much to invest in baseball. You don't need $200 million a year and a $600 million stadium renovation and 145-foot chocolate waterfall for recruits. Like, you don't need that stuff in baseball. It doesn't take as much. $50 million, let's say. And you spend it on baseball, and it's just like, I'm with you, man. Open up the piggy bank, back up the Brinks truck, blank check, whatever cliche you want. Keep this guy in Knoxville, because this is finally the guy that can actually return Tennessee baseball to being relevant again. And they are. I don't know how great they're going to be this year. The rotation's pretty solid. I don't know how great the offense is going to be, but this is a pretty good baseball team, right? And so he's clearly done that. Give him whatever he wants.
And also do something with the stadium. Like, you know what I mean? I've been to Vanderbilt's baseball stadium numerous times when I lived in Nashville, and saw some great college baseball. It's not huge. It's pretty cool. It's like 2,000 seats, man, 1,500, something like that. And it gives that feel. And I feel like Tennessee could do something like that, because right now, Lindsey Nelson, God bless it, it's just a concrete dump.
Yeah. And it's not complicated. This is not a complicated thing. Invest in facilities, invest in recruiting, invest in the coaching staff, invest in the stadium. Just invest. Give him everything he needs, and keep him from going back to Arkansas. Is basically the goal.
Please. I know. Braden Gall, dude, I had so much fun, man. I really appreciate you joining, and tell everybody where they can follow you, what you're doing nowadays, in your next podcast and broadcast.
Yeah, all kinds of podcasts. I got all the podcasts, right? So the 440, just go type in 440 anywhere you find podcasts, Spotify, Apple, whatever. You'll get all the shows. We do a daily show every single morning about sort of the state of Tennessee. A lot of Tennessee volunteer sports in there. Titans, Predators, Nashville SC when they're playing, the Grizzlies. Just sort of big stories in the state of Tennessee. It comes out every single morning. It's called the 440, less than 10 minutes. So it's just a really nice way to start your morning. I don't think anybody else is out there doing anything like this. And my kids are really excited about it. So just if you can hear them screaming in the background. So check that out. We have an SEC football podcast. It's sort of a Southern culture variety show with myself and Aaron Dugan. We got comedians on there. We got musicians coming on. We got football experts. So it's just that's called Fringe Element. That comes out every Thursday. So check that out. Last week we did the SEC East preview with Chris Doering. We're doing the SEC West this week with Cole Kubelik. The Nashville Predators podcast, The Gold Standard, comes out every Wednesday with myself and The Athletic's Adam Vingan, who is easily the definitive beat reporter on that beat. We think it's the best podcast anywhere you can find about the Nashville Predators, if you care about a bad hockey team right now. And then, of course, we do a media show, which we need to have you on soon, buddy. We do a media show on Fridays that comes out that just sort of talks about interesting personalities in the state of Tennessee and in Nashville and Middle Tennessee, about the problems that are with the media, how it's broken, how we can fix it. Just interesting stories. You know, we have Mike Keith on to tell stories about going to the Super Bowl in 99, like just interesting stories about how the media works. And that's sort of a pet project. So type in 440. We've got Titans podcasts. We've got all kinds of good stuff. So if you care about Nashville and the state of Tennessee sports, 440 Sports is your place to check it out. We do appreciate it. Rate, review, and subscribe.
Trust me, we'd have a lot to talk about, especially with Tennessee turning down everybody's 4-year request for the Fulmer situation. So, no, it's been interesting. Braden, thank you so much, man. Hope everybody goes and follows your work. You do a hell of a job, and we'll do this again soon.
Thank you, man, and congrats to you as well, buddy. All the hard work you do, I've been following you for a while, and I appreciate you having me on, man. I really do.
Thanks, buddy.